Welcome back to the Nature Stories podcast. I'm Samantha Brown. This week, an exploration of the Svalbard Islands in the Arctic Ocean, where scientists from all over the world have gathered to monitor what's happening to the climate and how climate changes affect our planet. This podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Each week, we bring you pieces about the intersection of people and place. Up now, When the Snow Melts on Svalbard, produced by Irene Quayle.
When the snow starts to melt after the harsh polar winter, the Arctic terns come to the end of their long migration, flying in over this white desert of snow-covered peaks to land on Svalbard. Some of them have flown from the other end of the world, and the same applies to another group of migrants of the non-feathered sort, making their way to this archipelago in the Norwegian Arctic. While the politicians at home debate the subject of climate change, scientists from around the globe make their way to Ny-Ålesund to monitor what's happening in the sensitive polar region and how changes in the climate could affect the life forms on our planet. Ny-Ålesund is the world's most northerly permanent settlement on the west coast of Spitsbergen, the biggest of the Svalbard Islands. Permanent, that is, for around 30 scientists and backup staff, the hard core who brave the hardships of winter to maintain the research station, one of the world's key polar facilities. Kaldeweis Station was named after the captain who led the first German expeditions to the North Pole from 1868. This is the Arctic headquarters of Germany's Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research and the French Polar Institute, IPEV. Up to 130 scientists will work here during the summer, no more than 30 at any one time. Rainer Falkenroth is the station leader. A physicist by training, he's no stranger to remote and extreme conditions. He sailed the North Atlantic before migrating to Ny-Ålesund at 79 degrees north, just 1,200 kilometres from the North Pole.
Well, we are looking to the north from Ny-Ålesund, and that's the view over the whole Kongsfjord. On the opposite side, we see an island, which does not appear like an island, but it is one. To the left, that's the western direction. That's the opening of the fjord into the Fram Strait. And to the east, it's the fjord is closed by the three Kronas, which are three really beautiful particular mountains around here.
For a bird's eye view, it's time to take a trip up the hill to Mount Zeppelin, an atmospheric monitoring station 475 metres above the village. Carl Nielsen is the duty technician this morning, an unusually fine day here, with bright blue skies and strong sunshine.
We're just about to take a cable car trip this morning?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to go up and look at the instruments at Zeppelin station.
Really warm in here today. Got to get this jacket off.
It's hot today, clear skies.
Yeah, global warming, you know.
We're making a joke about global warming, but actually global warming is partly what we're going to be measuring up here.
Yeah, that's right. It's all the greenhouse gases that is measured and also pollutants and particles in the air.
So you go up there every morning around about quarter past eight?
I'm one of three people who look after the instruments.
Here we are at the Zeppelin station. This is one of the key stations in monitoring CO2 across the planet.
Yeah, because here we have the opportunity to use every measurement that is done. Most other measurements will have different sort of strange peaks because something motorized is passing, like car, airplane, stuff like that. Whilst here it's unpolluted, there is no local source. Now this CO2 monitor is sucking air through this machine here. It's a drying unit. You see, it's important that the air is dry before it's tested. Then they find out the level of CO2. And then to make sure it's correctly calibrated, we have these bottles over in the corner here where we know the exact content of CO2s. And then we do test runs every so often on three different levels, so we have a good control over how the instrument is doing.
This is one of the stations where we have been measuring the rises in CO2 in recent years.
That's right. It's since 88 up here, and the oldest CO2 measurements in the world is Mauna Loa in Hawaii, and that's from 1958. And on both measurements, you can see a very clear exponential rise, starting on about 300 in 58 and then now on 390. And here you see it, 387.
387, we're talking in parts per million, CO2 in the atmosphere. And the rising trend is similar for methane and other greenhouse gases, which Carl and his colleagues also measure daily. Melting snow. Where does it melt first? What influences its course? Which way will the water channels run? And what will happen if the process is speeded up by warmer temperatures? Questions for scientists like permafrost hydrologist Bob Bolton from Alaska and his German colleague Sebastian Westermann. And we're about to try out the drone, their new flying camera.
It's a motorized paraglider.
So we're attempting to fly at altitudes of something like 100 meters usually.
Kind of, can you hold that up, like this way around? You can see how it's going to be. Okay, person who stands here and on the other side will just hold lightly on those flaps.
Okay, sure, I'm the GPS computer.
You can kind of use it instead of something like aerial balloons, for instance, but you have the possibility to relatively accurately position it. So this is what we try now. We have a little GPS system up there, and it's transmitting the signal down to the PC here.
The GPS is okay. I'm mostly looking at the system, seeing how it works for the hydrologic model that I'm setting up now. We're also doing a lot of snow studies. Did a large basin-wide survey just to see how the snow is distributed. And then we're also monitoring it to see how the snow melts, different patches, to where it melts out first, where it doesn't. Looking to see where the channel is. We're going to set up a weir, hopefully in another week or two, so we can measure the stream flow. And then with the drone, we're also taking pictures to see where the snow melts, and we'll use that information to compare against the model results later on.
Meanwhile, back at base camp in Ny-Ålesund, Marijke Petersen is on duty at the observatory. Marijke's been here for nearly 18 months, operating this Centre for Atmospheric Research. The composition of the atmosphere influences the climate and so conditions for life on Earth. Ny-Ålesund's observatory is probably best known for its LIDAR system, a laser beam especially effective in measuring changes in the ozone layer.
What you see here is just one part of our LIDAR system. We send a laser beam up in the atmosphere. Actually, we can measure data from up to almost 80 kilometers height. And all kinds of particles and molecules and aerosols, they reflect the light back. And the way the light changes, or the intensity has gone, or the wavelengths may be changed, then we know what kind of particles is in the air, and we also can figure out how high. It needs to be clear to measure, because otherwise all the signal will be lost in the clouds and we won't get any signal back.
So we've just stepped onto the roof. The sun's come out. We're surrounded by snowy peaks. We're looking down out across Ny-Ålesund.
Yeah, we have three big glaciers that you can see from here. We have the Kongsvegen, then we have the Kongsbreen. And behind, actually you don't see it from here, but behind this big island, it's called Blomstrand Island, there is the Blomstrandbreen. And this is actually quite sad, because the island was not an island 2 years ago or 3 years ago. Then it was covered from a big glacier, but the glacier has been reducing, so now it's an island. And you can actually see the changes year by year, how much the glaciers go back.
And those glaciers are our next destination. Station leader Rainer Fockenroth is taking three of us up the fjord on an expedition, including Valerie Granchet, a visiting French artist and photographer, and Ron Fischer from the Dutch University of Groningen, who's interested in algae.
We're using pretty small boats. Do they need to have any particular requirements for use up here in the Arctic waters?
Well, the hull should be a bit stable because you could hit some smaller icebergs or ice pieces on the fjord which come down from the glacier. Should be a bit of seaworthiness because there could be rough winds, but at all it should be handy to catch something or set out a diver.
But to go out in this boat, I have to wear this survival suit. Looks a bit like a space suit.
Yes, actually it does, but the water temperature at the moment is around 2 degrees Celsius, and if you fall into it, you're very close to hypothermia. Which means after 5 minutes you start to become unconscious. So you should keep warm if you fall into the water, and that's why we all wear these suits when we go out by boat.
So how long will you give me if I fall in wearing this suit?
And then it's about 16 hours.
Okay, I hope you'll rescue me before then.
Yes, we will. Well, we went to the east in the fjord.
Yeah.
So it's a place called Krukkefjellet. And this is a very steep cliff. And kittiwakes are breeding on that one. So the spot is on special interest of some of the biologists working on these birds and are also integrated into this food chain project inside the fjord, because the kittiwakes are eating young polar cod, and this one, the polar cod, is eating plankton, zooplankton. What you can see is on the rocks there's a lot of grass and moss growing, and that usually only happens in the areas where you have big bird colonies.
Chetty Zoirup is also out along the fjord today, a biologist from the Arctic harbour town of Tromsø, working for the Norwegian Polar Institute.
Here in Njålesund we had two projects, one on kittiwakes and one on eider ducks. And now we're going to have some blood samples from the kittiwake. We are doing analysis of these blood samples for contaminants, organic chlorine contaminants, and we are looking for some hormones, and we also have a small samples for measuring immune system. So this is a study where we see on survival and production related to the pollution.
How do you think these pollutants get into the birds?
The pollution gets into these birds from the food. So they contaminate it through the food chain, and the pollution is released to the environment, and in the marine environment the plankton take up the pollution, is going up through in the food chain and end up in these top predators like kittiwakes, like glaucous gull, and also humans.
Why do you choose this particular location to do the kittiwake research?
First of all, we have a very good place here in Njålesund to stay and to work, and also it's far up north, so it's a really long distance from the original sources of the pollution.
We're in a very spectacular spot.
Well, yes, actually, if you look on a sea chart or a map, which is about 10 years old, then we would stand in the middle of the glacier called Kongsvegen Glacier, and you can see just the rest of the ground.
So the glacier has retreated considerably in the last 10 years.
Well, it has retreated during the last 100 years also, but in general the glacier did not gain any further mass on top of it, and that's a result of research during the last 10 years. That actually since 2 years the glacier is becoming smaller than it was before in its complete mass of ice.
How far does this glacier go?
Well, the glacier is about 30 kilometers long to the top. It's in about 700 meter heights down to sea level. The front itself is about 40 meters high.
In the background, we can hear lots of melting glacier.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, when it starts to become warmer, the water of the glacier has to go somewhere of the snow that's on top of it. And this water is flowing into the fjord right here. It starts with a very small dribbling creek, and week by week becomes stronger until it's almost a fast-running river. If you go onto the glacier, you can see it and hear it very much meandering through the ice. So it's quite interesting channel, but dangerous also.
And it also, of course, changes the ecology of the fjord.
Yes, that's true. It's fresh water coming down from the glacier, and we have salt water in the fjord. And a lot of the zooplankton and also the fish depends on the seawater, on the salt water. So if you get more fresh water inside, you have a change of the living environment. So it's quite interesting to see what would happen if you have even stronger melting and by this a change of the amounts of animals or plankton in the fjord.
That's the scientist's view of the glacier, but our artist Valerie, who's taking photos for an installation, sees it with different eyes.
There is a beautiful, dazzling color which is going from the blue, sky blue to pink, purple, red, and the clouds are very low, and it's really like a watercolor, and it's very, very beautiful. You have a kind of natural architecture, and there's a mix in between mineral, liquid, and air, and all these elements are meeting each other here, and that's great. We are, you know, in between the solid and the liquid, and that's great. Yeah, it's perfect.
Standing
in the water, like
in
that.
The water. Coming off a glacier.
Yeah, I never shot it.
No, you didn't, okay. Whoops. On our way back down the fjord, we have to pull in as close to the glacier on the far side as safety allows for our algae expert, Ron Fisher.
How deep is it here?
About 10 meters.
10 meters, okay. You can see here clearly there's a river coming off the land. It might be fed by the glacier. And look at the water, it's all clay colored. And that means there's it's a freshwater input loaded with sediment, and that's gonna cover all the algae in the fjord. So this is really what we are looking for.
So will you be coming up here in the boat again next week?
Yeah, definitely. We definitely want to do measurements here. Look around, the water is really, within a kilometer, the water is getting grey.
As well as these boat trips, some of Ron's work is done on an abandoned jetty on the outskirts of Ny-Ålesund, at the other end of the fjord, where the water is as yet unclouded by the sediment the thaw will bring. Willem van der Poel is the other member of the team from Groningen University.
We have a rifle here because it's the outside of the village. Well, it's obviously no polar bear here now, but it's just because you cannot see very far here, and it's there are no fences around here, so just in case a bear would take the chance and walk up here, we have a rifle and a flare gun pistol.
Okay, then let's go to the jetty.
We're investigating the effect of the melting of the snow and the glaciers on the microbial community in the fjords. You can imagine if you give your flowers at home salt water, they don't like it. So the algae around here in the sea don't like the fresh water coming out of the snow. So and you can imagine that with global change, there's more melting, so more fresh water, so less algae, something like that. So we try to investigate that, and we do that in two ways. We go out on the fjords twice a week to measure temperature and depth profiles and salinity profiles as well, to see how far the fresh water comes, because it floats on the salt water, of course. And we have experiments running on the pier where we are standing right now, and we try to mimic the effects of the melting of the snow in experimental setups.
So how do you do that?
We have 12-liter bottles, and we keep them at ambient temperature when we put seawater through tanks. And in those bottles, we have a gradient of salinity, so from 35, that's normal salinity, to, I think, 15 or 20. And we put screens on it, neutral density screens, that blocks away the light. And when the snow melts, you get a freshwater layer on top of the fjord, but also that layer is really trouble. Now it's blocking the light because of the sediment that's in the water. So you have two effects, the freshwater and also the darkening of the algae, the shading.
I can't see very much actually in there.
Yeah, the microalgae, you only see them when they're really dense, so then the sea colors green. And they're not so dense around here, so you can see quite through. But that's also with the seawater, it's very clear. When we deploy our CTD, our measurement probes, you can see it up to 8 or 9 meters sometimes. The sea is really beautiful around here.
So how long will it take before you have any results?
We only do the experiments here, and then we're back in the lab in Groningen. We have to analyze everything, so half a year, maybe a year, because we take a lot of samples and it takes a lot of time to process them.
International cooperation is the norm here in Ny-Ålesund. Ron and Willem also collect samples for Claire Evans, originally from the British Isle of Man. I caught up with Claire in the Kings Bay Marine Laboratory in Ny-Ålesund, the most northerly marine lab in the world, ideally situated on the banks of the fjord.
Okay, what we're doing is I've set up an experiment this morning to try and quantify the amount of viral lysis and grazing that goes on the algal populations in the fjord. So I've just done all my filtrations, and now I have to put the bottles back into the fjord for 24 hours, and then we'll get them out again in 24 hours' time and take some measurements and try and work out what happened. So I need to get them in as quick as possible. Right. Okay, the bottles are just in here.
So you have to keep them in the cold room to keep them...
What I do is it takes me about 2 to 3 hours to prepare all the water, because they have to have different filtration steps. So what I do is try and replicate conditions in the fjord. So we keep them at 2 degrees and, you know, try and keep them as still as possible and things, and so they won't get physiologically damaged whilst I'm processing the water. Until comparatively or relatively recently, people didn't really realise how abundant viruses are in the marine environment. And actually, when they did start to look, they found that in just a milliliter of seawater, there can be millions of viruses, and that's in every milliliter of seawater. And they also found that these viruses are active in infecting the organisms which live within the water column. And what we're particularly interested in is the unicellular organisms, the bacteria and the phytoplankton, because what happens is the viruses infect these and lyse them, releasing their contents to the water column. And obviously, this can have significant implications for the flow of matter and energy through the food web, because, of course, if the cell is lysed, then it's not available to higher trophic levels to consume. And also, what we're particularly interested in is its potential impact on climate change or global change with relevance to carbon. Because, of course, if carbon passes up the food chain, it gets into the higher trophic levels, so things like the whales and such. And when these die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean, taking the carbon with them, and this is called the biological pump. But of course, if the viruses are lysing the cells that feed the food web, then this carbon's no longer available to pass through the biological pump. So what the effect of this is it sequesters more carbon in the top part of the ocean, the euphotic zone. So basically leads to there being more carbon in the oceans and then more carbon in the atmosphere, or the top of the oceans anyway. So that at the moment, what we're trying to do is basically get a handle on how active the viruses are and see if their activity is changing as the oceans change with global change.
Why is Svalbard a particularly good place to do this?
Well, obviously, interest in these kinds of things is growing and people are looking all around the planet. But our particular interest at the poles is these areas are more susceptible to climate change, or what happens is we see the changes happening quicker here. So we can use them as early warning indicators of what might happen in the rest of the globe. So it's good to get a handle on what's going on here.
The samples that are processed in the Kings Bay Marine Lab have to be taken from all depths of the fjord, a job for the station's scientific divers. Michael Bartz comes from the German Baltic coastal city of Kiel.
The whole summer we will do, well, a whole bunch of jobs actually. Very, very different. Very exciting. This is the Arctic, no question. So this is a very, very special dive spot. You can only get here as a scientific diver. And, well, right now the visibility is very, very good. Water is cold, but very clear. So there's a lot of things to see, especially the algae are like an underwater forest, you could say.
So why do you always work in groups of three?
Yeah, that's very important. You always have one diver underwater, then one guy is responsible for the rope. So the diver will always be on a rope. And the third diver is a rescue diver that will always... he or she will always stand by in case of an emergency.
Max Schwanitz heads the Alfred Wegener Institute's team of divers. He's just come in with his finds, including a bucket of colourful sea snails.
Today we were out to take some samples some scientists ordered. So we found some buccinum, the snail here, and some algae, De Valeria, and they will go to the lab now and will set into the lab experiments.
How did you know what you were looking for? Did you get a special description beforehand? Or do you identify them on pictures? Or?
After some years working up here, the dive group knows a lot about the environment here. And we get a kind of order list from the scientists. So they write us the day before what they would like to have. And if it's not clear, we can look it up in some books which we have in the dive locker. And then we agree which animal we have to find or which plant we have to collect.
Snails, plankton, algae. It may all sound pretty exotic and far from the problems of everyday city life, but the research being conducted here on Svalbard is of relevance to us all. In fact, some of the smallest of the organisms being studied here play an essential role in maintaining life on Earth. I made a final visit to one of the cold rooms in the lab with marine biologist Ulf Carsten from the German University of Rostock.
These are sediment cores which has been taken yesterday by divers from about 5 meter depth. And these tubes contain now sediment, silty sediment of a dark color. And on top you can see a brownish layer which derives from these diatoms, these benthic sediment living microalgae. And these organisms are, in a global context, very important because they produce about half of the marine primary production. And on a global scale, if you calculate all the rainforest and the boreal pine forest and so on all together, they account for about 25% of total primary production. This means that every fourth oxygen molecule you will breathe in as a human derives originally from these organisms. So in the ecological context, they are extremely important.
So what exactly are you looking at when you look into these bottles, when you examine the samples?
First of all, we look for who is there. So we make an evaluation of biodiversity. How many species and their abundance? This is one question. The second is to see how productive they are, how much oxygen they produce. These organisms are very well studied in temperate to tropical regions, but we have huge gaps in knowledge on the polar regions. In former times, it was very difficult to go to the Arctic or to Antarctica. These days, we have this wonderful lab here in Spitsbergen to get an evaluation on the performance of these organisms for this fjord system here in New Orleans. What are they doing over the summer? What are they doing in winter when it's dark, when there's no light? If we have this data, we can say this is like the reference data. And the next step then is to see what will happen if climate change continues. It's getting warmer here in the Arctic, for example. So what is happening to these organisms? Are there any changes in their activity? Will they disappear? Will other species appear? We just don't know.
Irene Quayle produced that piece. Visit the Public Radio Exchange at prx.org to hear more pieces like it. Support for this podcast comes from the Nature Conservancy, online at nature.org/stories, committed to protecting nature and preserving life. I'm Samantha Brown with Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Join us next week for a brand new Nature Stories podcast.